Okay, so this is about 2:31. Uh-oh. How come our projector's going away? About 2:31. I might have to turn the lights off. Oh, maybe it's coming back. Oh, good. Come on back. And it is October 19th. We're going to start talking about nervous tissue today. And the other important kind of announcement, oh, a couple others, is that we're scheduled to have a test a week from today over muscles and this first chapter on nervous system. All right, so I think you guys are doing pretty good with muscles, but we do have to pay attention to that first chapter on nervous system. I don't know if I can cover that all today. If not, I'll cover a little bit of it in lab next time as well. Okay. And your practicums are graded, right? So we can go over them tonight after class if you're going to stick around. If not, then I'll upload them to the web. I don't know if I probably don't want to say one thing or another. Some people that did really well on the practicum, and hopefully that's you. Okay. I didn't look at a distribution, actually, to really know. Okay, so let's see. I got to go get some slides. Okay, why can't I go and get some slides? Minimize. All right, so let's see. Nervous system. Ah, good, here it is. Okay, so I'm going to start out with this. Kind of looks like a flow diagram right here. All right, when we were looking at tissues, there are four major kinds of tissues in the body. All right, there is epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. And way back when, we learned that there are two major cell types that make up nervous tissue. What were the two major types? There were neurons, which conduct electrical impulses, and then the support cells, which we call neuroglia cells. Okay, so that's one way to break the nervous system down, is by the two different kinds of cell types. Another way you can break the nervous system down is by a structural division where we find nervous tissue. Right, and the two basic places where we see nerve tissue is in the central nervous system. And outside the central nervous system is what we call the peripheral nervous system. So the two main divisions are central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And in particular, the central nervous system is made up of the brain and spinal cord. So anything outside the brain and spinal cord, by definition, is the peripheral nervous system. All right, so you should have this flowchart available to you whenever you're studying anything that has to do with nervous system. Right, this chapter, the central nervous system chapter, autonomic nervous system, peripheral nervous system, you should always refer to what we're talking about with this particular diagram. All right, furthermore, the peripheral nervous system can be broken down into two divisions as well. And these two divisions are going to be a sensory division. This is the first one. And sensory just means that these are nerves that are taking information from your periphery into your central nervous system. So it's bringing in sensation to the central nervous system for your consciousness, for your appraisal, because it might interact with other physiologic processes that are happening inside your body. It's going to control your heart rate, your breathing, Okay, it's going to maybe control your thirst if you're dehydrated, for instance. So if you're low on calories, it's going to give you the sensation of hunger, for instance. Visual signals from your eyes are afferent or sensory signals. All right. So sensory signals or the afferent division brings information from an organ to the CNS or central nervous system. All right. The other part of the peripheral nervous system is the motor. And another name for motor nervous system is called the efferent nerve or efferent system. All right. So we have afferent and efferent. I'm pronouncing them just a little bit, mispronouncing them a little bit. Usually we say afferent and efferent, but sometimes if I'm talking really fast in lecture, if you don't hear me quite correctly, then you might get them mixed up, right? So I exaggerate the A and the E a little bit so that it's really easy to understand. So an efferent neuron takes information from the central nervous system out to the periphery, so it's going the opposite way. So afferent and efferent are exactly the opposite. Furthermore, we should break down the motor or efferent division into two different divisions as well. There's somatic versus autonomic. And somatic just means that it's voluntary, right? So these signals are generated from your consciousness, and we'll look at the part of the brain that generates these. But in particular, the only part of your body that you have conscious control over are your skeletal muscles, which are really, that's really kind of fascinating to think of that. Everything else is taken care of automatically by the autonomic nervous system. So somatic nervous system is CNS to skeletal muscle, that's voluntary. The autonomic nervous system, right, is what we call visceral. It's going to, oh, I think I have it written down at the bottom of your page. The effector organs for the autonomic nervous system are cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. Right? So if we take cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, glands, and skeletal muscle, that's everything in your body that needs innervation. All right. So furthermore, the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into two divisions. Right, so a lot of these little arrows are just a chapter all by themselves when we get to it. The autonomic nervous system is a chapter. The two divisions are the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. This is an automatic nervous system that is controlling smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And you should be able to relate this to, say, the biceps brachii and the triceps brachii. What can you tell me about the relationship between the triceps brachii and biceps brachii? They're antagonistic to each other. And this is true of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. They are antagonistic to each other. They have different outflow pathways that we'll look at. But for instance, if the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory on the heart, guess what? The parasympathetic nervous system is on the heart. It's going to relax it or it's going to inhibit the heart. Right? So you might not know in every case whether sympathetic is excitatory or inhibitory. The only thing that you will know for sure is that the parasympathetic and sympathetic are going to be opposite to each other. Okay. So in this particular case that I mentioned, sympathetic is excitatory on the heart, parasympathetic is inhibitory. On the digestive system, it's the opposite way around. It's the parasympathetic that is excitatory and the sympathetic that is inhibitory. So that you can't develop a good feel for until we talk about it a little bit. You just know what? That they're going to be opposite to each other. And what's the beauty of having antagonism in a control system? What does it allow? Balance. Yes, precise control and balance. Okay. All right, so that's a really good diagram to appreciate. And your book has a flow diagram a little bit different. All right, so the nervous system, in general, is the master control and communication system of the body. All right, so its functional divisions. We have sensory input carried by afferent neurons. We have motor output from the central nervous system carried by efferent neurons. And then we have the neurons of the central nervous system themselves, and we call those interneurons or association neurons. Association neurons are completely contained within the central nervous system. All right, so let's see if we have kind of a picture of these things. Indeed. All right, so here's the whole nervous system. In yellow, we see CNS, made up of brain spinal cord. All the red is what we find in the peripheral nervous system. So those are going to be nerves and things we call ganglia. We'll describe what a ganglion is in just a little bit. Okay. So the overall architecture of the nervous system is that in a functional sense, we have afferent neurons bringing signals to the CNS from receptor organs. We have association or interneurons within the central nervous system for integrating up all the information that is coming in via afferent nerves, and then making a decision on what to do with all that information. Right? So right now, you're probably not motivated to get up and run away, but what were to happen if this eyeball was looking at a bus that was coming straight at you? Then this integration center would make a different decision and say, well, we better get out of here. Right? All right, so the integration center is made up of interneurons or association neurons. When it makes a decision, it sends that decision out via an efferent pathway to effector organs, like, for instance, skeletal muscle right here. Okay, and then that muscle is going to protect you from further damage. So you got afferent, efferent, and in between in the CNS you have association neurons. All right, so that's a general architecture of the nervous system. Okay, let's look at a neuron. What does a neuron look like? Here's a pretty good example of a neuron. So here's a micrograph, but what I want to focus on is this illustration right here. It gets a little washed out right here, but I want to talk about all of these things. So the yellow represents a neuron which carries electrical information. This kind of neuron is what we call a multipolar neuron. Multipolar because it has a number of really short processes coming off the cell body. The cell body is the center of mass of the cell. It contains the nucleus, it contains rough endoplasmic reticulum, and things that stain very darkly. So sometimes we call these Nissl bodies or chromatophilic substance. These are proteins that are being made by the cell body. Right? And these short processes, these are what we call dendrites. And usually there is one very long process, and that is what we call an axon. So the three major parts of a neuron are the dendrites, the cell body, and an axon. Another name for cell body is soma. Soma just means cell body. Okay. The dendrites and cell body are the receiving end of the neuron. It receives information from other neurons. The axon is the sending part of a neuron. It sends information long distances very, very quickly. Right, so the cell body is microscopic. Right, the axon could be maybe a meter long. It's still microscopically thin, so you can't see it, but it is still very, very long. All right, so we see the nucleus with the nucleolus right there. How do you think of that nucleolus? This is just it's just a little spot inside the nucleus. Can anybody remember what the job of the nucleolus? That's the active part of the nucleus, right? That's where transcription is taking place. So this is an active cell. All right, so all these dendrites collect signals, and the signals then find their way over the cell body and then get into this funnel. And this funnel right here is called the axon hillock. So all the signals funnel into the axon, and then the axon sends that signal all the way down to the axon terminus right down over here. So the axon hillock is a pretty important part of a neuron that you should be aware of. It's the interface between receiving signals and sending signals. And a neuron transmits information as a one-way street. Information can only go in one direction. And it goes from dendrite to cell body and down an axon, never the reverse direction. Right? And that information we call a nerve impulse. And here you can see the direction of that arrow right there. Right? So it always goes dendrite, cell body, down the axon. All right, the other things that we see on this particular slide, this is a really good exam figure that you should be familiar with. We have some support cells, and these support cells are called Schwann cells, and they kind of look like little pearls, right, strung along the axon. And these Schwann cells wrap a layer of fat around the axon, and it acts like insulation that you have on a wire. So a lot of wires that we have laying around, like what you plug your toaster into the wall, does it have insulation on it, or is it a bare wire? It's got insulation, because if it was a bare wire and you touched it, you would get a shock or electrocuted, right? All right, so the same thing for these Schwann cells. It acts as insulation, and it allows this nerve impulse not to flow down an axon molecule by molecule by molecule, but it allows it to hop from one cell to the next cell to the next cell to the next cell. So a nerve impulse actually skips down an axon, and when it does that, it's very, very fast. So the Schwann cells lay down a layer that we call a myelin sheath around the axon that allows the nerve impulse to jump from one space between a Schwann cell to the next to the next. The space between a Schwann cell is what we call a node of Ranvier. All right, so think of maybe running down a flight of stairs. All right, what do you think would be faster? When you ran down a flight of stairs, if you had to step on every single stair on the way down as fast as you could, or maybe you could skip every other step and land on every third or fourth step, what would be faster, as long as you didn't fall? Yeah, skipping down, right? So when a nerve impulse skips down an axon, we call that saltatory conduction. And saltatory conduction is fast. If an axon does not have myelination, then it moves down by what we call continuous conduction, molecule by molecule, and it's relatively slow. So what would be a better kind of neuron to have? One that's myelinated or non-myelinated? Myelinated. It's faster, right? You could respond a lot more quickly to threatening circumstances. You could get signals to muscles, right, to do what you want it to do much more quickly. All right, so myelination is a really nice advantage that some neurons have. At these axon terminus right here, there are little swellings. There are little swellings. I don't know if I can really see them right here. Okay, on these axon terminals, sometimes these little swellings are called terminal buttons or bouton terminali. Right, they contain the synapse, and we're going to talk about a synapse coming up pretty soon. Right, and that's what sends a signal to the next neuron. Right, so that is the basic neuron, and this one right here is what we call a multipolar neuron. So I'm going to want you to know three different kinds of neurons for the test. This shape right here is a multipolar. Okay. So let me find some different... How am I going backwards? I'm clicking the wrong one. Okay. All right, so here are the three basic shapes of neurons. We just got done talking about this one right here. This is a multipolar neuron. We got a bunch of dendrites and only one long axon. Oh, now I can see the swellings on the tips of the axons right here. Those are the terminal buttons or bouton terminali. This is a multipolar neuron. And you should also know the function of a multipolar neuron. Multipolar neurons carry signals from the central nervous system. Like here I see a picture of the spinal cord. And here is a muscle. Right, so here's a muscle. Here's the direction of the impulse. So I could ask you, what kind of neuron is this by its function? And remember, what are the functions of a neuron? It could be afferent, could be efferent, or it could be an association neuron. So it's labeled on here, but the synonym is used. What's the function of this neuron right here? Okay. Look at the arrow. It's going from central nervous system to an effector organ. And so that's a motor neuron, so that is an efferent neuron. That's an efferent neuron. It's taking information away from the central nervous system to contract this muscle. So that's a perfect example of what a multipolar neuron is. It's a motor neuron or efferent neuron. Another example, oh, and somebody mentioned this, I heard you say that. Another example is that they also make up interneurons. And these are neurons completely contained within the central nervous system. Like here is, let me really zoom into this area right here. Here is a neuron, and I guess it's beginning to look blue to me. Right, so here's the cell body, here's the axon. It's relatively short, but it is what? Completely within the central nervous system, so that is an interneuron or an association neuron. Both of those are good functions for the multipolar neuron. Another kind is a bipolar. Bipolar, we have the soma or cell body with two long projections coming out of either side. So we call this a bipolar neuron. We don't have many bipolar neurons in our body. They're only associated with some special sensory organs like the eye and the nose. Okay, so they're important for hearing and vision and smell, but that's about it. That's where we have these bipolar neurons. Nonetheless, it has a dendritic process and an axonal process right here. You can tell that this is the axon because of these swellings on the tips of the axon terminals. This is where neurotransmitter is going to be released from, right here. Okay. Then the last kind is a unipolar neuron. And we call this a unipolar neuron because from the cell body, how many processes are coming out? Just one, right? So that's a unipolar neuron. And then it bifurcates into two processes after that. So this short process, or this single process, is very, very short, and it bifurcates, right? These are the receptive endings right here. What's another name for a receptive ending? Mm-hmm. Those are dendrites, right? This is the sending processes over here. These are what we're going to call the axon terminals. So this right here is what we call the peripheral process of this unipolar neuron. This is the central process. But let me describe to you why we call it these different processes. Let's slide over here. And let's zoom in. All right, so can you picture this blue neuron as being a unipolar neuron? Here's the cell body. Here is that short single process leaving, so it's a unipolar neuron, and then it bifurcates. Look where this one bifurcation goes. Where is it going? Into the central nervous system. And because it enters the central nervous system, we call this the central process. And what about the other process? Where does it end up? It's part of the peripheral nervous system. So this is what we call the peripheral process because it's in the peripheral nervous system. All right. But look at this direction of nerve impulse. It goes from the periphery into the CNS. What kind of neuron by function is that? Is that motor or sensory? That's sensory. And what's a sophisticated term for sensory? Afferent. So this is an afferent neuron. So all unipolar neurons are afferent neurons. Okay. Let's look at this bulge right here. And here's a dot. What does that dot, that blue dot, represent? That represents the cell body of this unipolar neuron. And in this region of near the spinal cord, we might have thousands and thousands of thousands of sensory nerves coming in, all with their cell bodies right here. All right, so this is still in the peripheral nervous system, and a group of nerve cell bodies that forms this little bulge in the nerve right here is called a ganglion. So a ganglion, by definition, is a group of nerve cell bodies, and there might be dendrites in there as well, in the peripheral nervous system. So on that first page that you have, way up over here, peripheral nervous system, you should write in what? That structure, ganglion, that's right. So where you're going to find ganglia are in the peripheral nervous system. Furthermore, you should have on the tip of your tongue what a ganglion is. It's a collection of something. It's a collection of nerve cell bodies. Nerve cell bodies. Okay. All right. All right, so those are the three kinds of neurons. And the job of a neuron is to send electrical information from dendrite to cell body down an axon. That's the job of a neuron. Okay. The other kinds of cells that we have, okay, in the body, besides neurons, are support cells or supporting cells. Sometimes we call these neuroglial cells or neuroglia cells. Can you say neuroglia? Yeah, I guess you guys have said that already. Okay. Neuroglia cells. Okay, and we have a number of them. We probably have about six of these kinds of cells that we find in different parts of the nervous system. So let's go see what they look like. The neuroglia cells. Ah, here are some right here. Okay. These four types of neuroglia cells we find exclusively in the central nervous system. Okay, not in the peripheral nervous system. Let's see, which one should we talk about first? Maybe this first one right here. It kind of looks like a star with all these sun rays coming off of it. We call that an astrocyte. But if we look at an astrocyte, we see that it makes connections between other kinds of structures inside the brain. It makes a connection between a neuron and a blood vessel, in particular a capillary blood vessel. Right? So an astrocyte can take materials, helpful materials like glucose, directly from the blood and deliver it directly to a neuron. Because neurons are highly metabolic. They need a lot of glucose in order to perform their function. Astrocytes also maintain the electrolytes or the balance of ions around the neuron. And we're going to see how important various electrolytes are or ions are for nerve conduction and also for synaptic transmission between neurons. Astrocytes maintain the balance of various chemicals on the outside and inside the neuron. Astrocytes also, okay, even though they can act as a special delivery system from blood into this neuron, notice how they surround this blood vessel right here. They can also act as a barrier for other substances that are harmful to the brain. So many, many toxic substances that end up in our blood from food that we eat or drink don't have access to your brain because they can't leave the circulatory system because of these astrocytes. Astrocytes make that barrier called the blood-brain barrier. That's another function of an astrocyte, makes a blood-brain barrier. And indeed, if anybody comes up with a drug to help this neuron right here, if a pharmaceutical company comes up with a drug to kill a brain tumor or to treat some kind of brain problem, a lot of effort has to go into figuring out how to get that drug from the blood through the blood-brain barrier into the brain. That's a very difficult process to do that. A drug just won't automatically do that. Probably takes millions of dollars to figure out how to get around the blood-brain barrier, right? Because his brain doesn't know that exogenous drug is there for its benefit or not. It's just trying to keep out everything that it doesn't know about. Okay. All right, so that's the astrocyte. All right, but you can also see that since this astrocyte is reaching out and touching numerous neurons and blood vessels, it kind of acts as a support system. It almost acts like a little bit of connective tissue within the brain. It's not connective tissue, it's really nervous tissue, but it provides a little bit of a framework and support for the brain. Another real important function of an astrocyte, okay, is the following. Okay, we used to think that neurons were the most important cells of the nervous system because they were important in transmitting information from one place to the other. But now we've learned that these support cells are very important because this astrocyte will tell this neuron where to make connections and maybe where it should grow to reach out and touch other neurons. Right? So these astrocytes actually help the brain tissue, the nervous tissue, the neuronal tissue actually grow and develop inside the brain. And that's a way that we can now explain the learning process. When somebody learns new information, these neurons actually make new connections between other neurons. And that is controlled by these astrocytes through a chemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Right? So when you take a course, like an anatomy class, guess what your brain has to do?
Suffer.
It's got to suffer. It's got to feel a little stress, I suppose. Right? So I'm using your terminology. All right, but it's got to grow. It's got to make new connections. The neurons have to actually grow and make new connections. Just like if you were to walk around all day and flex your forearm with a 5-pound weight, what would happen to your biceps brachii? Well, it would get tired, but eventually it would get bigger and stronger. Okay? And the same thing for your brain. When you use your brain and learn new things, it actually gets bigger and stronger in a sense that new connections are made between the neurons of your brain. So the brain that you have or had before you took an anatomy class really structurally is nothing similar to the brain that you have afterwards, because it remodels itself. It makes new connections in there, right? And that actually makes you smarter as a result of that. So that's another job of the astrocyte right here. All right. Microglial cell, kind of looks like an astrocyte, but the processes are smaller. This cell can wander around inside the brain, and it's very similar to a white blood cell. We haven't talked about blood cells in here, but does anybody know the function of a white blood cell? What's it doing in your blood, the white ones? They fight infection. So the microglia cells fight infections. If you have bacterial infection, viral infection, hopefully no fungus gets in there, but every once in a while, I suppose that could happen. When tumors start to grow, you know, hopefully these microglial cells can recognize that as a tumor doesn't belong in your brain. And guess what it's going to do to those bacteria and those tumors and those viruses? It's going to kill them, right? And then what happens? Well, then you don't have that tumor anymore. We probably all have had tumors in our brain, but never developed to the stage where it was a problem because of these microglia cells right here. And that can also explain why every once in a while somebody goes through spontaneous remission of cancer, right, where they have a brain tumor and the physician might say, well, guess what, it's inoperable and, you know, you have 3 weeks to live or whatever, and they just spontaneous recover. Here could be a nice explanation. Maybe these immune cells figure out how to recognize that tumor and then destroy it, right? That's really the most beautiful way that you could ever have somebody recover from a disease process, and that is what? Allow their own body to fight the infection, right, without going through radiation, chemotherapy, or antibiotic treatment or whatever, because any kind of treatment has what? Has side effects, right? So if somebody's own body can take over and do the job, that's the best circumstance whatsoever. Okay. All right, so these cells we find in the central nervous system, all of these. So the third cell is called an ependymal cell. There are cavities inside the brain, and a cavity inside an organ sometimes is called a ventricle. The heart has cavities in it that we call ventricles. So there are cavities inside the brain filled with fluid. These ependymal cells line all the cavities. So that stuff inside this fluid doesn't really have access to the neurons, because there could be bad things in this cerebrospinal fluid. Right, so it acts like a little barrier, but a few of these cells in a few locations in the brain actually work to secrete the fluid into the cavity. That fluid is called cerebrospinal fluid, and it has the proper electrolyte balance, and it has glucose in it, oxygen, and it can also carry away waste products from the brain. Right, so this epithelium right here, even though these are nervous cells, kind of acts like a synovial membrane. Where have you run into the synovial membrane? In joints, right? What's the job of the synovial membrane? It secretes synovial fluid into the joint cavity that lubricates the joint cavity. Well, that's the job of these ependymal cells in a few places in the brain. It secretes cerebrospinal fluid into the brain. And we'll carry on with our discussion with cerebrospinal fluid when we get to the next chapter. So that's the job of the ependymal cells. They help form that structure called the choroid plexus that makes CSF. And CSF is what? Cerebrospinal fluid. Okay. All right, then our last cell is called an oligodendrocyte. Oligodendrocyte, you can see, is wrapping something around an axon. That's very similar to a Schwann cell. What do we call that, wrapping around an axon? That's the myelin sheath. Yeah, myelinating process. And that acts as insulation so that a nerve impulse can actually hop from one end of the cell to the other, right, speeding up the rate of nerve conduction. Now, this is different than a Schwann cell because a Schwann cell just wraps itself around one axon, but an oligodendrocyte can wrap itself around numerous axons. And this kind of cell we find in the central nervous system only. The Schwann cell is what we find in the peripheral nervous system. So all these are neuroglia cells in the CNS. In the peripheral nervous system, these are the neuroglia cells that we have. The Schwann cells, say for instance around this, what kind of neuron does this look like to you? What are our choices? Multipolar, bipolar, unipolar? Okay, but let's look. We've got just a single process coming down. Single process is unipolar. Yeah, unipolar. So this would be a good example of a sensory neuron. These are the dendritic processes over here. So this would be the peripheral process. Here's the central process going into the spinal cord. And it is myelinated with Schwann cells, not oligodendrocytes. The other kind of support cell that we see surround the nerve cell body. And these are what we call satellite cells. Way back when, this sort of reminded somebody of our solar system with the sun in the middle and what? Around the sun. The planets around the sun. And somebody figured out that those planets were satellites of the sun. And when you look at a micrograph, these actually look like little planets circling around this neuron right here. So they were called satellite cells. But they don't move like planets. But, you know, they didn't have microscopes that could take videos of things back then and put it on YouTube. They could only take pictures. So they really couldn't tell that they weren't moving, right, like planets. All right, so satellite cells and Schwann cells are what we find in the peripheral nervous system. And all of these guys over here, astrocytes, microglia, ependymal, oligodendrocytes, we find in the central nervous system. Okay. All right, so pay close attention to the functions of these cells in your notes. Okay, so on the test, I could show you a picture of any one of these cells. Make sure you can tell me what kind of cell it is and know something about its function, too, okay, for the test on Monday. All right, so here is an interesting comparison between some nerves that are myelinated. Okay, so look at this first, this upper illustration right here. What kind of neuron does this look like? Does that look like a bipolar neuron? Many, many dendrites, multipolar neuron, okay? And then, what are these cells right here? Schwann cells. Schwann cells we only find in the peripheral nervous system. And the function of these Schwann cells is to speed up a nerve impulse as it's moving down an axon because of saltatory conduction, right? So the nerve can actually hop from one cell to the other, to the other, to the other, from node of Ranvier to node of Ranvier. As opposed to this arrangement down here, I see three different axons, right? But there, these three different axons have myelin from one oligodendrocyte. This oligodendrocyte is the kind of cell that we see in the central nervous system only. But nonetheless, there are nodes of Ranvier between them. So oligodendrocytes allow for saltatory conduction as well, or fast conduction of nerve impulses. All right, but that is only in the central nervous system. I'll say some more maybe about that a little bit later on. But, so that myelin is really important for maintaining the proper timing of nerve signals through the brain. And every once in a while, somebody's immune system gets upset with these oligodendrocytes. It recognizes the myelin of these oligodendrocytes as being a foreign body, a foreign substance. So what does the immune system of that person do to these oligodendrocytes if it thinks that they're a cell from outside the body? It attacks them and kills them. right? And it destroys the myelin sheath in these axons that are in the central nervous system, and that disrupts the function of these axons, tremendously disrupts the function of them, and that's what we call multiple sclerosis as a result of that, when the myelin sheath is damaged. And it's pretty easy to see on various imaging kind of techniques, because the brain looks a whole lot different in that one area. It forms different plaques. So that's a very debilitating disease. Fortunately, in the last 15 years, 20 years, medicine has become very familiar with how to control multiple sclerosis. Can't cure it, but it can extend the periods of remission and shorten the active flare-up times, right? So it's very controllable. But of course, some days will be better than others for people with multiple sclerosis. All right, so those are the cells. And we got the different kinds of conduction. Okay, let's talk about the synapse. And the synapse, I want you to become familiar with in the following sense. When we were looking at the cell, I asked you, what's the structural and functional unit of life? That's a blast from the past. What's the structural and functional unit of life? We talked about it in this class. The cell. Yes, thank you. The cell. You're exactly right. What's the structural and functional unit of compact bone called? The osteon. Osteon. And osteocytes are a part of that, of the osteon. So structural and functional unit is kind of nice because it's a simple description, but if you know how that one unit functions in all of its complexity, you know how the whole bigger structure functions, right? If you know how a cell functions, then basically you know most of the important things about life. What about the structural and functional unit of contraction? What was that called? The contraction, like a muscle. What's that? Structural and functional unit of contraction. That's a sarcomere. The sarcomere, you know, and what's a sarcomere? It's got the actin and myosin, right? The Z-discs, a lot of complexity. But if you just say sarcomere, okay, then that kind of, that says it all. So for communication between cells, the structural and functional unit is a synapse. So you got to know some structure of a synapse and some of the function of the synapse, and then you'll really know how cells communicate with each other. Okay, and we got two kinds of synapses. The first kind is what we call a chemical synapse, and the second kind is what we call an electrical synapse. And by far, the chemical synapses are most common, especially in the brain. There's a few places where there are electrical synapses, right? In particular, in cardiac muscle. All right, so let me just diagram a chemical synapse. Here we have a nerve cell body, and we got an axon, axon terminus. And the axon terminus does not touch the neighboring cell right here. So here's the second cell with an axon, axon terminus. So information, how does information go in this neuron right here? I guess I could put some dendrites. It goes from dendrite to cell body down an axon. Remember, it's a one-way street, just like this. All right, and what about this neuron here? Same thing, right? Because it's a neuron, goes like this. All right, so information moves along a neuron as an electrical signal, and it moves along as an electrical signal here. But now, what about this space between the neurons? Electricity just can't hop from one space to another. Like maybe if I rub my shoes on the carpet and then I reach out to touch you, what would happen? You get a little shock, right? There'd be like a little lightning bolt going from my fingertip to your shoulder or whatever. All right, so for electricity to hop across a space, there has to be a lightning bolt. But in your body, there are no such things as lightning bolts hopping between cells, right? Okay, so something special has to happen here. this information, which is electrical, in this area right here, gets converted into a chemical signal. And the chemical signal moves across this space, and it starts another electrical signal in this second neuron. So the way information is passed through a chemical synapse is what? It's an electrical signal, gets converted to a chemical signal, and then it gets reconverted back into an electrical signal again. So the information is a chemical signal. Since this is a neuron, that chemical, generally speaking, is what we call a neurotransmitter. That's a neurotransmitter. And there are various kinds of neurotransmitters, and maybe we talked about one in particular in this class already, and that was acetylcholine. That's a very common kind of neurotransmitter. Okay. So acetylcholine works as a synapse. What kind of synapse does acetylcholine operate at? A chemical or an electrical synapse?
A chemical
synapse. Okay. All right, so I'll say something more about electrical synapses in a little bit. All right, so let's look at chemical synapses. What do we have right here? A chemical synapse is right here. All right, so here we have two neurons. Information flows from this first one into the second one. And can it go backwards?
Mm-hmm.
Can't go backwards, right? Because every neuron, the signal can only go in one direction. And as a matter of fact, you'll see that the signal within the synapse can only go in one direction as well. And we'll see why that is. All right, so let's zoom into this region right here. See that little swelling right there? That's the terminal button or the Bouton terminale. So here is the, let's zoom in. So here is the axon terminus. Right here, here's that little swelling. And it's enlarged because there are mitochondria in here. And it's loaded with vesicles that we call synaptic vesicles. And inside these synaptic vesicles, there is the chemical that's going to move across the space between the cells, which we call the synaptic cleft. The cleft is the space between the cells. So synaptic vesicles contain neurotransmitter. So what could be in these vesicles right here? Give me the name of a neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine. There could be acetylcholine. And it's stored within, okay, this right here, this neuron is what we call the presynaptic neuron because we find it before the synapse. And the second one is what we call the postsynaptic neuron. Right, so the pre- and postsynaptic neurons, and in between them is this nice chemical synapse right here. Okay. So when a nerve impulse comes down an axon, it's a big electrical event on the membrane. And when electricity comes down the axon, it allows calcium to enter the cell. So calcium, right, is a signal for these vesicles to come to the presynaptic membrane, fuse with the presynaptic membrane, and when it does, it's going to secrete the neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. Right, so what's really important for you to appreciate is the signal that starts outside the cell that enters the cell that causes these vesicles to move over to the membrane right here. What did I say that was? That was calcium ions, right? And Ca stands for calcium. That's just a chemical signal, a symbol for calcium. All right, so calcium has to enter this synaptic terminal right here in order to release neurotransmitter. And once it's released, that neurotransmitter, see these little dots right here? I guess maybe I should zoom in. Okay, this neurotransmitter moves over to the postsynaptic membrane, right? It's on the other side of the synapse, and it causes an electrical signal to develop in the postsynaptic membrane. And where does that electrical signal go? It goes over the dendrite cell body down the postsynaptic axon, down to the end of the axon on the postsynaptic cell. All right, so that's what we call synaptic transmission. What's important is that calcium ion that has to enter the cell in order for these neurons to communicate with each other. All right, so if you are you, which you are, all right, what do you think is more important in terms of calcium? Would you rather have strong bones, or would you rather have a nervous system where nerves could actually communicate with each other? Yeah. What do you think would be more important? The nervous system, exactly right. Right, so calcium is really important for synaptic transmission, and when your body starts to run low on calcium, as what's going to happen to all of us if we're lucky enough to live long enough, guess what your body decides to do? Sacrifice your brain or sacrifice your bones? It sacrifices your bones, and what do we call that process? Osteoporosis, and of course you probably agree with that because you couldn't function at all without a brain or nervous system, right? It's not that you would really like to have brittle bones that fracture, but that's the least of your worries if you don't have a nervous system, right? So calcium is very important for synaptic transmission. And when your body starts to run out of calcium, guess where it goes to get it? Bones, because bones are a reservoir of calcium in your body. Okay. All right, so this is a typical kind of chemical synapse. And this should remind you of the neuromuscular junction. Okay, the neuromuscular junction is a junction between a nerve and a muscle cell, and it uses a neurotransmitter. Anybody remember what the neurotransmitter was at the neuromuscular junction? It was acetylcholine as well. Okay. Okay. The only difference between the neuromuscular junction and the synapse right here is that on the muscle cell, once it gets stimulated, it's going to contract, and it might pull away from this neuron right here. So there are special connections between the end of the nerve and the muscle cell so that they don't pull apart. That's really the only difference between them. Okay, so again, calcium is important for controlling skeletal muscle. So without proper calcium levels in your body, your nervous system could even tell a muscle to contract. And what's a very important muscle that you use every couple of seconds? Your heart, that's for sure. Your heart won't beat without proper calcium levels. Your diaphragm for breathing. So again, without proper calcium levels, you can't breathe, your heart won't contract, and that's much more important than having strong bones. But you don't have to give your bones away as you get older, because what can you do? Exercise and diet, right? So exercise them, because bones can get bigger and stronger if you exercise them, just like a muscle, just like your brain, just like any other kind of tissue. Okay. All right, so this is basically just what I said so far, but maybe let's look at some of these questions right here. Can information ever be passed from the postsynaptic neuron back to the presynaptic neuron through the synapse? Can it go back the other way? So let's look at the synapse. And the answer is, nope, it's a one-way street. Why is that? Because it's only the presynaptic neuron that has neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic neuron doesn't have neurotransmitter, so it can't pass the signal along. It has no signal to pass along to the presynaptic cell. Also, in order for neurotransmitter to excite the postsynaptic cell right here, there has to be a receptor for the neurotransmitter. And only the postsynaptic cell has a receptor. The presynaptic cell doesn't have receptor, so it can't be sensitive. It can't be the receiving part of a neuron. Only dendrites and cell bodies have receptors. So only dendrites and cell bodies can be the receiving end of a neuron. All right, so that's how I would answer that question. What else? How is information transmitted within a neuron? Is what kind of signal? Electrical signal. How is information transmitted between neurons? As a chemical signal. So therefore, we call that a chemical synapse. Okay. And this Oops, I don't want to change the margins. This I'm not going to test you on. But you can look it over and you'll probably see that again sometime, not in this class, but in other classes. All right, let's talk about resting membrane potential. When I say the word potential, that means like the ability to do something. There's potential energy. That's not energy in motion, but that's energy waiting maybe to do something in motion. Like when you stretch a rubber band and hold it, that has potential energy so that when you release it, what happens? It snaps back together. That's kinetic energy. So potential means the ability to do something if you let it go. And another name for potential is voltage, right? It's an electrical property. Right, and there is something called a cell membrane potential, which is really the same thing as a cell membrane voltage. And here's a freaky thing about taking physiology and anatomy classes. You learn that every cell in your body actually behaves like a battery, or actually is a battery. What do you know about batteries? You can charge and uncharge them. Yeah? Ah, there's two terminals. Okay, anode and cathode, two terminals, right? Plus charge, minus charge for a battery. And you use them to power various devices. Well, every cell in your body that's alive actually acts like a battery. Okay, so let me show you how that happens a little bit anyway. Where's that figure? I got to go get it. It's in your book. I don't have it in this slide. At least I don't think I have it. Let me go back. I don't think this is it. Nope, let me go get the updated version. And then maybe here, and then maybe here, and then, here it is. Now, if you want this picture, what should you say? Save target as. Let's put it in, I guess this is okay with me. 231. Okay. Basically the same picture, but it's got a couple little additional little features to it. Okay. So here we see a cell. What kind of cell does that look like? Is that a neuroglia cell or a neuron?
Neuron.
Really good. What kind of neuron? Multipolar neuron, right? Bunch of dendrites, one long axon. Is it myelinated or non-myelinated? Okay. I don't see any Schwann cells on there. Don't see any oligodendrocytes, so it is non-myelinated. This one's non-myelinated. I don't see any of those little white things on there. Okay. All right, now this cell is alive because it's acting like a battery. Notice the inside of the cell has a bunch of negative charges, and on the outside of the cell we see a bunch of positive charges. So depending on where you look, you're either going to see positive charge or negative charge. Okay. Furthermore, what do you know about charge, electrical charges? Do opposite charges attract, or same charge attract? Does positive attract positive, or does negative attract positive? Opposites attract, right? Because they'll neutralize each other. This is true. And that's why batteries are used as energy devices, because all these negative charges are just dying to get out here, right, to move and neutralize these positive charges. And that's an electrical current when that happens. And you can use that for energy. All right. So we said calcium is what kind of ion? I mean, Ca is what kind of ion? Calcium, thank you so much. All right, we got another ion right here. It's abbreviated Na. You don't have to know a bunch of these, but maybe three in this class. Okay, this is natrium, which in English is, you don't speak that language, that is sodium. Okay, all right, so that's sodium. It's got a positive charge, so it's an ion. And when it moves, that's an electrical current. Another ion that we have in our body is this one right here. It's an ion and that is kalium. Okay, but we don't use that word in English. That is potassium, but that's why they end up with these symbols, right? So sodium, potassium, calcium. Calcium is really easy to understand. And because of these electrical charges, they're involved with what? Producing electricity in our body. So we're very electrical beings because of these ions that we're made out of. And we only function if we have the proper levels of these things. All right. So when we have a cell at rest, where is there the most negative charge? Inside the cell. So that's something you got to memorize. Cell at rest, it's negative on the inside compared to the outside. Okay. Furthermore, the ions that are responsible for that primarily are sodium and potassium. And sodium is going to be high in one spot and low in another. Where is sodium going to be high concentration? Outside the cell or inside? On the diagram in your book, you see sodium in a resting cell is high on the outside and it's low on the inside. So that means that sodium will want to run into the cell if possible, run down its concentration gradient from high to low. Right? Now what about potassium right here? Where is it high? Inside the cell. All right, so that's three pieces of information that you just got to memorize. All right, and so it's not part of this class to tell you how that happens or why it happens and why the membrane potential develops from that, but that's just something you got to know. You got to know that in a resting cell, it's negative on the inside, sodium is high on the outside, potassium is high on the inside. Your book is labeled properly, this slide isn't, because on the slide I see sodium with a 1 right here. What should that really be? That should be a plus sign. Okay, same thing for this potassium. In your book, it's correct because these are ions. And maybe it's sort of right because how many plus signs would you have here by potassium?
One.
Maybe that's why they put a one there. I don't know what happened. All right. One plus sign and one plus sign right here. All right, so this is a cell at rest. And what could you tell me about this cell if something happened to this membrane potential? If you had the same number of positives and negatives on the outside and the same number of positives and negatives on the inside, what could you tell me about a battery where that was happening?
Dead.
It was a dead battery. What about this cell? It would be a dead cell as well. All right, so that's another interesting analogy. Okay. So that's a cell at rest, but neurons transmit electrical signals. This is how they transmit electrical signals as an action potential. So an action potential, action means what? Something happening, right? Something moving. Electricity moving. An action potential has got two parts to it. The first part is what we call depolarization. The second part is what we call repolarization. And then if it goes repolarized, it goes back to resting conditions, right? So depolarized is exciting. Repolarization is going back to a resting condition, right? And what you should know about depolarization is that it's due to one of those two important ions. And in particular, which one do you see it is? It is sodium. Sodium is moving. Which way is it moving? Inside the cell. Right, so neurons work first by depolarizing, that's sodium entering the cell, and then how does a neuron repolarize? You see potassium leaving the cell, and when it leaves, you get back to resting membrane potential. And the cell, the neuron then can transmit an electrical impulse all over again. Okay, so I know you can't really understand what's going on here. It takes about a week or 2 weeks in a physiology class to describe exactly what's going on here, but you should at least know at this level in a physiology class, right, that cells are very electrical in nature. They can transmit electrical information with an action potential. An action potential has got two phases, depolarization, which is due to sodium entering the cell, and repolarization, which is potassium leaving the cell, okay? And that in a resting cell, sodium is high on the outside and potassium is high on the inside. And if you can memorize that, that will make a physiology class a lot easier. How much easier do you think? It will make it about 10,000 times easier. Okay? So it's really worth knowing that. Okay. All right. So this number I don't want you to memorize, right? This is the resting membrane potential, 70 millivolts. That's about a tenth of a volt. Okay. All right. Let's talk about some terminology right here. Let's see. Okay. I have to figure out where we were in the class. Let's look at some terms. This is sort of like defining for bones what a foramen is, right? What a process is, what a fossa is. All right, gray matter is a group or a cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And if you look at, let's go back, where is that cell at? Oh, yeah. Okay. What part of this neuron right here is myelinated? The axon, because of these Schwann cells. Dendrites and the soma, or the cell body, is not myelinated. All right, so dendrites and cell bodies look kind of gray when they're put together, when there's thousands and thousands of them. All right, so gray matter is made up of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. The other kind of matter we have in the nervous system is white matter. And white matter is a result of what? All of these Schwann cells or oligodendrocytes that are made up of myelin. Right? When you look at it with your naked eye, it looks white compared to gray. Gray is darker. So it's actually a very nice contrast and it's easy to observe. Right, even without a microscope or any kind of imaging equipment. You can tell what's gray matter and white matter. So gray matter is nerve cell bodies and dendrites. White matter is myelinated axons. Bless you, bless you, bless you. I think that was three times. Okay. All right, the CNS cortex, central nervous system cortex, is made out of gray matter. It only contains nerve cell bodies and dendrites. It doesn't contain axons. And that's where all the cells are interconnected with each other, with all those dendrites. All right? So, when we look in the central nervous system, the cortex looks gray, but every once in a while, if we go deep inside the brain, there's going to be a lot of white matter, but every once in a while, there's going to be an area that's gray. All right? So what does that mean, deep inside your brain when there's this area that's gray? What parts of neurons do we find in that area right there? Cell bodies and dendrites, right? And this is a functional center that usually is performing one important function, and we call that, this is sort of an unfortunate term because it's used a lot in different areas, we call that a nucleus. So this area that looks really dark gray in the central nervous system, which is only made up of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, that's a nucleus, like the basal nuclei. The thalamus is a nucleus. It's made up of just those parts of a neuron. And the same thing in the peripheral nervous system is what we call a ganglion. So a ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. And I remember seeing that. Where was that? Right over here. Here is a sensory nerve coming in. Here is the cell body. What kind of neuron does this look like again? Unipolar neuron, right? So there's a nice sensory unipolar neuron. You're going to have thousands and thousands and thousands of nerve cell bodies right here from these unipolar neurons in this area. It causes this bulge. It's in the peripheral nervous system because here's the spinal cord. This demarcates the spinal cord, so this is peripheral nervous system. So a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system is what we call a ganglion. Right? Okay. So on that very first slide right here, right, I think you have, or maybe I didn't tell you to put it, peripheral nervous system put ganglion. The counterpart to a ganglion in the central nervous system is called a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system is called a nucleus. So nucleus and ganglion are similar, except one is in the PNS, the other is in the CNS. Okay. What else? We should have white matter. Is that next? Mm-hmm. White matter. Well, what's white matter due to? Axons that are myelinated. Axons, and what do axons do? Do they receive information or send information? They send information, so white matter is responsible for sending information long distances, and it's myelinated. That's why it looks white. All right, and there we got a couple different kinds of white matter. If it's white matter in the central nervous system, namely, it's going to look like something like central nervous system like this, thousands and thousands of these axons that are myelinated, right? If you look at it with your naked eye, it's going to look white. We're going to call that a tract, a nerve tract. So back on this first slide, right up over here, underneath central nervous system, what should you put? You should put nuclei and nerve tracts. Now the counterpart to a nerve tract in the peripheral nervous system is what we call a, not a tract, it's just called a, you're going to laugh when I tell you. It's just called a nerve. Yeah, it's called a nerve. Okay? So peripheral nervous system, you've got ganglia and nerves. Central nervous system, you've got nuclei and tracts. All right? So nerves enter the central nervous system, and right when they enter, we don't call it a nerve anymore. We call it a tract. And when nerves leave the central nervous system, it's a tract, but as soon as they leave, we call it a nerve. All right, so they can be almost the exact same things, but just in a little bit different location. All right, so where's that sign-in sheet at? Did I pass it around? Good. Anybody need the sign-in sheet? Okay. I don't think there's a class in here right afterwards, so I think I might just stay right here so you guys can see your practicums. Okay? I didn't post them yet. Okay? But I do have them. I'll post them tonight if you don't want to stick around. If you can't stick around, okay. So I don't think we got done with this chapter yet. So you know what? You got to come to lab on Wednesday in case I have to postpone the test. Okay. But I can't make up my mind right now though. So you got to come to lab. Thank you. Oh, I got to turn off my microphone.